On this episode of Video Culture, our Halloween episode with Poltergeist and the Monster Squad.
Did you rewind it?
I don't know.
In a time where everyone has a podcast, in a place where everyone has an opinion, two heroes, Matthew and Ryan, against all odds, are here to save your movie viewing experience from total disaster. Your trip through the video aisles of yesteryear begins now. There will be chills. There will be thrills. And there's a good chance that Ryan will have a coffee spill. They'll discuss the quality, cultural significance, and more detail, frankly, than you bargained for. Here's your host, Ryan Acree and Matthew Essery.
And thank you for joining us for another episode of Video Culture. I'm your host, Ryan Acree.
And I'm Matthew Essery.
And this special Halloween episode. And we started off this episode choosing a couple of movies. Like, you wanted to do just, like, PG horror movies, right?
Yeah, because that's something that people don't really talk about, was the idea that, you know, everyone you think of scary movies, you think of, like, blood and guts and, like, you know, Michael Myers, Jason Voorhees, for Freddy Krueger, Pinhead, Leatherface. But, I mean, there's lots of great movies that you can actually watch with your kids or with the whole family. And we started going through the idea of, like, you know, PG horror films. And the reason we didn't just call this straight up PG horror films was that Monster Squad is actually PG-13. And then I thought, well, Poltergeist was almost rated R. So it felt a little weird to label it as PG horror when it definitely skirts the edge of that concept. But
we should all know, and a lot of people who watch movies should know, that the PG-13 rating wasn't created until after Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom in 1984. So by the time 1985 came around, there was a PG-13 rating, which, you know, with being the Monster Squad being made in 1987, definitely garnered PG-13. But like Poltergeist being made in 1982, it's just rated like PG. And mm-hmm. A lot of people think horror movies and they immediately get that rated R, you know, thing, because they're thinking of movies like The Exorcist or Texas Chainsaw Massacre or Friday the 13th, you know, Halloween, you know, Nightmare on Elm Street, you know.
And I don't know about you, but both these films, Poltergeist and The Monster Squad, were movies I saw when I was pretty young.
I saw Poltergeist when I was very young. You have to remember, I was born in 76. I mean, obviously, and then Poltergeist came out in 1982. I didn't go to the theater to see Poltergeist, but I remember watching it on TV. So it had to be, like, after it came out on video. And, you know, we had a VHS, like, very early on in my household, because my dad had to, you know, videotape, like, football games. That's mostly what he got. You know, we had a VCR for. But yeah, we watched VHS tapes, and I remember watching Poltergeist on VHS, like, very early, because it was a PG movie. It was, like, kind of, you know, spooky. It did kind of have this tone of, you know, just everyday America, like, this could happen to anybody kind of thing. It was very popular at the time.
Yeah, I saw it on HBO for sure.
Okay.
And I know it's one of the movies that I famously watched in, like, pieces. You know, that happens a lot when you're a kid and when you're watching things that air on television. Sometimes you'll see, like, the middle here, the end here. Very rarely would you ever catch these things at the beginning and then watch it all the way through. So I watched Poltergeist probably two or three times as a kid in, like, chunks.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So I never quite understood the order of the film until, honestly, just recently, because this is actually the first time I've watched it since I was a little kid. So well, it was kind of fun to go back and kind of see how it all fits together.
Well, and that's really odd because most of it takes place in the house. Like, you hardly ever leave that whole thing. So to me, it had this very, like, you know, we talked about the Burbs and, like, they never leave the neighborhood. And it's kind of like the same thing here. Like, you never leave the neighborhood and you hardly ever leave, you know, the house, basically, in the setting. So let's just go ahead and talk about Poltergeist. It was 1982. It was directed by Toby Hooper, or he's mm-hmm. at least credited with Poltergeist, but we'll get into that.
That's a whole conversation, yeah.
That's a whole separate thing. But, I mean, he was from did he do Texas Chainsaw Massacre, basically?
He did. He did Texas Chainsaw Massacre 1 and 2. He wrote and directed both those. He's one of my favorite directors simply because of that. And so, I mean, so.
No, it was produced by Steven Spielberg and Amblin Entertainment. But Steven Spielberg had a very sort of like heavy hand in Poltergeist. But E.T. also came out at the same year in 1982. So he was very busy like trying to get both films done, right? So.
Yeah. Well, what was struck with me when I watched it, and I don't want to get too deep into the conversation already before we really go into like the basics of it, but I could really see the moments where you could really tell that Toby Hooper was doing was really fully in charge of it, and then you could see things that felt very Spielbergian, mm-hmm. like it almost from scene to scene, it would feel like, that feels way more like Toby Hooper. This feels way more like Spielberg, and sometimes those feelings would kind of meld together. Mm-hmm. But that's one reason I find Poltergeist pretty fascinating. Sometimes it feels very much like the guy who made Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Sometimes it feels very much like the guy who made E.T. And sometimes it feels like those two ideas are kind of in simpatico and working together to make something really interesting that's a melding of both.
Yeah, that's an interesting observation because I think that you're also, like, when you watch the movie, there's like normal everyday American life, and then there's also like this supernatural thing that's going on, you know, with it. So there's a lot of like heartfelt sort of like family moments where you see a family just kind of, you know, being their normal everyday family life, but then there's also this underlying you know, supernatural thing happening that, you know, is the plot for the whole movie. But it's definitely you definitely can see a little bit of that where it's split, where it like takes you to the edge, but then it just kind of brings you right back into this you know, very comfortable family life, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I agree. And so for our listeners who maybe have not seen Poltergeist, what's the plot of Poltergeist, Ryan?
A young family are visited by ghosts in their home. At first, the ghosts appear friendly, moving objects around the house to the amusement of everyone. Then they turn nasty and start to terrorize the family before they kidnap, quote-unquote, the youngest daughter. So that was written by Rob Hartle, on IMDb. So thank you very much. It stars Craig T. Nelson as Steve Freeling, and most of our audience knows Craig T. Nelson from the TV show Coach. He was the head coach. So either you know him from Poltergeist, or you know him from Coach, or you know him from both. Go ahead.
And I got to say, one thing, I don't know, and a lot of our audience probably also knows him as the voice of Mr. Incredible.
Yes,
from The Incredibles.
This is very true. He was also on the TV show that was in the 2000s called Parenthood. As the kind of the patriarch of the family, Joe Beth Williams plays his wife, Diane Freeling. And then you have Heather O'Rourke playing Carol Ann Freeling, which is she's the little girl who gets kidnapped. She's like about 4 or 5 and gets kidnapped and taken to this like underworld or whatever.
Yeah, basically, she's really the biggest pop culture thing that came out of Poltergeist. Like, I'm sure everyone has seen the spooky little kid saying, "They're here." That's Carol Ann. That comes from Poltergeist.
Yeah.
For those who don't know, who haven't seen the film. And that's had a huge ripple on pop culture since this film came out. I mean, that has been parodied and spoofed and homaged literally countless times.
Yeah, I mean, the movie starts off with just pitch black, and they're playing the national anthem. And it's like this very, you know, kind of older recording of the national anthem. Like, why are they playing this? And I was like, wait a second, this is the 80s. TV station still went off the air in the middle of the night. And when they signed off, they played the national anthem. So this is like the signifying, like, and then it just was like snow, right? It was just like snow. And then, but that's when like these, you know, other beings would sort of like communicate with the little daughter with Carol Ann and get her attention.
Yeah, that's one thing that's going to be very, very weird for younger listeners to think about, is this movie was made during a time when TV was not constant. TV would actually end every night, and you would just have static.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's what it shows. I mean, that's the opening scene where they're, Craig T. Nelson is like in front of the TV, and he's fallen in, fell asleep in front of the TV.
I'm just talking about like you know, younger viewers were going to look at that and be like, what happened there? Why is it just snow? Yeah. Did they lose their cable signal?
Yeah, it wasn't cables, just whatever was, you know, over the air, the antenna or whatever. So, and then you have, then they bring in like some, so everybody kind of gets spooked. Then like things go crazy and things like really start off really slow, really normal. And then they just like when the paranormal activity starts happening, it just like it just takes off.
Well, and it's not even presented as something that's really scary at first. And that's one of the things I think is very brilliant about Poltergeist, is that it gives you time to really like the characters. Like you end up really liking Craig T. Nelson and Joe Beth Williams' characters and the kids. You get to see how they interact as a healthy family unit that love each other and support each other. And they're just very normal and like nice people, and then these crazy things start happening. And at first, it's kind of in that kind of like again Spielberg-esque kind of sense of awe, like look at this crazy thing that's happening. And then it just quickly turns ugly after that. But you got to get 20 minutes where it's nothing like that, where it's kind of like a family drama with a little bit of sense of supernatural like suspense.
Well, and even the at first it kind of focuses on the youngest boy, right? And first is on Robbie Freeling, who is scared of the tree that's outside of his house or right outside his window, his bedroom window. And he's also afraid of this like spooky little stuffed clown that sits in this like rocking chair. And you know, I had the same sort of feeling. I don't think I was afraid of the tree, but I was definitely had this like, you know, scary feeling of the you know, of the clown or like something sitting in a chair or something like that. And the other, what was I going to say? Where was I going? Sorry, I hear my garage door opening and it distracts me. But so basically, no.
You've actually got a poltergeist, is what you're telling me, Ryan.
Yeah, I do. My wife coming home from work is, you know, causing the garage door to go up and down. No, but Craig T. Nelson, when there's that storm that happens, Craig T. Nelson comes in and tells, you know, his son, tells Robbie, like, well, when you see the lightning, like, count. And this is how far back I remember this movie. Like, I still do that to this day just because of that scene.
I was going to say the same thing. When I was watching it, I had this moment where I remembered seeing that as a kid. Like, I mean, and as a little kid, because I'm younger than you. And having my little mind blown by that. And I started doing that to get over storms, like counting between the lightning strikes to see how close and far the lightning was. And I still do that to this day. So you and me both. So that's funny that you had the same experience.
Yeah, the same exact experience. I mean, it almost so much that I almost implant my own father. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, and I can tell you, Craig T. Nelson is really great in this. He's such like this. He's like the every dad. Like he is. Yes. Such like the like supportive, like strong, like father figure. Like he's almost like a sitcom dad, put in this extreme situation. And Joe Beth Williams is really kind of wonderful as like this very supportive, loving mother too. Like they're really almost like the perfect movie parents.
Oh yeah, like they have a great relationship. You saw them, you know, you see them, you know, hanging out in their bedroom together. Like, she's even, like, smoking pot, and, you know, they're, like, just kind of hanging out. And you see him
joking with each other, like lovingly joking with each other.
You know? Yeah, and you see, you know, him. He has the guys over there watching, you know, football, and you know, you see him, like I said, like calmly talk to the, you know, kid and being this dad, being this fatherly figure, and you know, and so yeah, I mean, it's just it's absolutely amazing to watch. And then he's this regular guy who puts on a suit and goes to work and. You know, does his thing. He's like the perfect dad.
Yeah, so often movies feel the need to manufacture drama and that kind of stuff. Like, they want the parents to be troubled or one of them to be emotionally damaged in some way. And you really don't need that. In fact, a lot of times it makes the characters harder to relate to.
Yeah.
And so I think it's one thing I really love about Poltergeist is that the characters are just... Everyone in the film... really is likable, and they're just trying to do the best they can.
Well, I mean, they seem like my parents. They seem like, you know, they seem like my family that I grew up with. They seem like, you know, the relationship that he has with his wife is very much a lot the same sort of relationship that I have with my wife and our kids and stuff like that. So it's very, very relatable. It is not out of the means by any such necessary. What is odd is the situation that they're put in, and that's what you get focused on. That's what becomes the focus, because everything else like seems so normal, I guess you would say, you know?
Yeah.
And so yeah, and then they have to bring in the experts, and they document everything, and you know, more crazy stuff happens after, you know, Carol Ann gets taken, and then they bring in I don't even know if they said her name. But I know maybe once, but Tangia Behrens is her name in the movie. But we all know her as like Zelda Rubinstein.
But yeah, they definitely say her name in the other Poltergeist films. But you're right; I'm not sure if they even say it in the first one.
Right.
But yeah, she is such a unique character actor.
Yeah, she's just like kind of, you know, shorter lady. She's like the medium that they bring in to like clean the house, right?
Yeah.
And it's, she just plays that character so well.
Well, they said that she's the person who's calm in all this chaos,
mm-hmm.
and she's sort of unassuming. And I always like the idea of in horror films of the idea of the heroic figure in horror films, because a lot of horror films don't have that. But whenever you do have characters who are basically brave in the face of unknowing evil, I find that really. Really fascinating and interesting. I love those kind of heroic figures who stand up to the boogeyman in these films.
Mm-hmm.
And that's definitely what she is.
Yeah, it's almost like, you know, Amityville Horror or whatever, where, you know, they're not doing a seance or whatever, but she assesses the situation very calmly, and like she gets it and understands and can explain the problem to the parents and explain what's going on to them in a very unique way, where, you know, cause she's explaining it. And then like, you're also understanding it as an audience about what's happening. You know what I mean? Cause nobody, this is the first time that, you know, most America even heard of the word poltergeist and understand what that means.
And you bring up a good point that she understands immediately and she accepts. That's another thing I really like about this film, is other films that try to do this have these moments where the characters who are going through this supernatural event try to explain it to others, and no one believes them. Mm-hmm. So most movies waste like 10, 15 minutes of their plot having the, please won't you believe me, these crazy things are happening scenes, and this doesn't do that.
Yeah.
You know, everyone they tell about it accepts it.
Yep.
Which is nice, because it means you don't waste that time.
Yeah. Well... They don't know how to explain it to their neighbor, right? They're just kind of like, okay, whatever, neighbor.
Yeah.
But they don't tell anybody else. They're very careful who they explain it to. And they only explain it to the people like, you know, Steve Freeling, Craig T. Nelson. Craig T. Nelson's character only explains it to the people that he can trust or whatever. And even when they bring, you know, Zelda Rubinstein's character in, then they, you know, the wife, you know, Jo Beth Williams' character, she even questions, you know, her credentials or whatever. and they have to, you know, calm her down. Like, no, she's helped out a lot of people, you know. So,
yeah.
But yeah, you're absolutely correct. I never really thought about that at all.
It doesn't do what you think it's going to do, and I guess it's because we're watching this now with perspective, with all the movies that came after it, that they do have those scenes and those tropes.
Yeah, like Ghostbusters, like, you know, The Lost Boys, like, you know, all these other films that are similar or have similar things where there's like supernatural things happening. I mean, even the other movie that we're going to talk about in a minute, Monster Squad, you know, definitely has a lot of that, you know,
where like no one believes them. And that, to me, that as a viewer, that gets a little bit frustrating because you just want to get on with it, you know?
Yeah.
Because when you're having those just believe me scenes, you already are there because you know what's going on. Mm-hmm. So it's just kind of wasting your time as a viewer because you're just waiting for the other characters to catch up with where you already are.
Yeah. And to me, I don't think you want the, you know, not that it's going to, but the where you don't want the audience to question whether it's real or not either. Like, maybe wasn't, you know, was it a dream sequence? Was it this or whatever? Yeah.
Unless that's the entire point of your film, which that's a whole different conversation.
Yeah, but right. Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but you're right. Yeah. But when it's clearly happening, you don't want the audience being like, maybe they're crazy, because then you lose sympathy for the characters too.
Yeah, for sure. I know you have a deep respect, and I had a deep respect too of all the practical effects that were in the movie as well. Right?
I loved all the animated stuff, all the stop motion. See that kind of stuff. To me, it's nostalgia,
uh-huh.
And even though it doesn't look any more or less real than if it was, you know, newfangled CGI, there's just something very, to me, warm and endearing about stop motion and animation.
Uh-huh.
Well, I just find it nice to look at.
Well, I'll just go ahead and answer the question where, you know, like what moments would you want to like watch back again or rewind and watch again? Even though that it's kind of scary, but to me, just from a technical standpoint, where they have the camera and then like the room is like rotating, you know what I mean?
Oh yeah.
So like where Carol Ann kind of gets like sucked into the closet or whatever, how they achieve that effect is that the camera is like stationary and it like moves with the room. So that therefore everything in the room can like move with it, but like you from a perspective standpoint, like you just see objects moving around in the room, and it's a really, really neat effect. And you know, to do that practically and to do that in like in a studio like they did is absolutely awesome. And I love watching those two scenes because there's two scenes where they use it. One where the Carol Ann gets sucked in, and they use another one where like. The wife is like in the bedroom or something like that, I think.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. She's like in her little t-shirt and she's on the ceiling.
Oh, yeah.
And,
yeah, right. It's near the end where they're like, yeah. And yeah, she's having to like crawl on the ceiling and all that kind of stuff. And you're like, whoa, that is really crazy. You know, so.
Yeah. Yeah, that whole dancing on the ceiling effect is what I always think of it as. You know?
Yeah, oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
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 So what were your favorite moments that you would want to watch again?
Honestly, I love the end when they're starting to escape, when they're trying to escape from the house and all the bodies are shooting up out of the ground.
Yeah.
Which is really great practical effects of the corpses, because that's, you know, we're to get into spoilers, of course.
Yeah.
The whole thing is happening because the entire place where they're living and the entire like suburb complex was built on an ancient Indian burial ground. Another thing that's become a real
just
gag.
A burial ground by itself, where they just moved the heads, relocated the headstones, but didn't relocate the bodies.
Yeah, and that was just kind of become like a gag in of itself in pop culture, is the idea of building something on like a burial ground.
Yeah,
but yes, but the idea when all the like coffins are shooting up and the corpses are falling out, and they're trying to rush to the car. Such a cool little scene with the lightning and. It's a good melding of again Hooper's sensibilities with Spielberg's sense of like awe.
Mm-hmm. And even the developer. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, but the developer even gets, you know, his in the end, right? You know,
yeah. Like, he realizes how badly he sees all this chaos he's caused by cutting corners and not respecting the dead. And yeah, it's a really fun scene. And it's cool, man. But there's a lot of really cool scenes in Poltergeist. There's the scene where Carol Ann is first taken, or when they rescue her with the closet and the ropes and mm-hmm. all of that. There's so many good scenes in this film.
Yeah.
I even love the scenes of, like I said, of them as a family just hanging out together. Like the scenes where Craig Nelson and Joe Beth Williams are just kind of like smoking pot and joking with each other. That's a great scene.
Or the quiet moment, like at night, like the first night that the people from the university are there to observe, you know, and there's this quiet like family moment between all of them, and they're like whispering and talking and stuff like that. Yeah. Like,
it takes its time to let you get to know the characters and like them, and that's why the movie works so well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. I don't have anything to add, Ben.
Okay. Well, is there any scene? Is there anything you would take out of the movie?
I tell you, the one scene I was trying to look for this. You know, I'm starting to look for this more and more as we watch these movies. And the one scene I didn't like was when they do bring the observers over and they say, "Oh, let's go in the room." You know, because he says, you know, we don't go in the room anymore. Yeah. And they want to see it. And they open it up. And it's just like, it's very sort of cartoony.
It's almost, cartoon. I was just, yeah. That's my least favorite scene, too, where everything's like swirling around. And you see like a Hulk doll on top of a like toy horse.
Yeah, and there's like a protractor playing a record. You know, just like, it feels very sort of. Who Framed Roger Rabbit-y, you know what
I mean? Yeah.
Even though that movie came much later.
Well, it's you're right. It's very cartoony, and it feels almost slapsticky.
Mm-hmm.
Like the tone of it is weird.
Yeah.
And it's such a brief scene. You don't really, pardon me, you don't really need it.
No.
Like you just had them open the door, have like the sound effect, and then shut the door really quickly, you would have had the same... like plot progression,
or if it was a little bit scarier, you know what I mean? Because on all the other scenes, it was like super duper scary. Like you don't want to go in there. People getting shocked. I mean, it's just like that's a crazy room. I think it needed to be
more subtle. Yeah,
yeah. And I don't think it needed to be like kind of just like, oh, there's all these objects swirling around. Like I think it needed an element of fear. I think a little bit more.
Yeah, yeah. To me, that's the one time in the entire film I was going to say the same scene where, the tone is just off. But it's only 30, 40 seconds?
It's a really brief
little thing.
Yeah, and it's really just to demonstrate, how odd and how sort of haunted, quote-unquote, that the house is or whatever, you know?
Yeah.
So
I think it's one of things where I think that they thought the effects were neat and they wanted to use them. I don't know,
mm-hmm.
but I mean it's the one little thing about the movie I really don't like.
Yeah,
yeah. So if I was going to fast forward through anything, it'd be that.
I think we're both in agreement there. But classic iconic movie, and I don't really think like I remember being a lot more scared when I was younger. I remember the scene where the chairs were like, you know, up like where they stacked. And I remember watching that for the first time. And I remember thinking, you know, it's kind of like, you know, like you remember where you are when you learn about this, you know what I'm saying? Like mm-hmm. when you learn that like Santa Claus is not real or something like that. Right. Yeah. And where you learn about this different world. And that's where I learned that there's this other like paranormal world. And these other things that can happen, and that really kind of like spooked me out a little bit. But I did like the scene where there was like where they were the chairs, and you were like could go from one end to the other, and you know, like was it the little boy did it where he like went from one side to the other or something like that?
No, it was Carol Ann. They put a little football helmet on Carol Ann and had her shoot across the floor.
I wanted to do that. I want to be like, I want to do that now. I thought that was cool. So even though that I was a little spooked out by how weird it was and like knowing that there's this other world, then, you know, I thought that was, you know, like you said, like it was, you know, like I said in the intro, it was kind of playful, but then turns, you know, bad.
Yeah, I'm going to go off on a tangent for just a second.
Okay.
You're talking about discovering the idea of the supernatural and all of that. When I first started realizing that was a thing, was, again, because of TV, because we were both children of TV.
Yeah.
Were those, do you remember the Time Life books that used to advertise on TV?
Oh, yeah.
Unknown phenomena? Like, it'd be like, yeah. It'd be like a 12-book series about aliens and the pyramids and ghosts. And they always had... That kind of spooky narrator is like, learn about the other worlds Time Life books. And so that's kind of where I first started thinking about the idea of like ghosts and aliens and stuff like that. Oh, that's immediately what you made me think of when you're talking about like discovering the idea that the world could be supernatural.
Or there was this other supernatural world that was, you know, kind of parallel with our world or something like that.
Or like Tales from the Dark Side. Remember that TV show, Tales from the Dark Side?
Yeah.
Because it had an intro that was like, there's our world, and then there's another world, and it would have like it would go like the reverse negative image.
Yeah,
yeah,
but that wasn't like. Are you talking about Tales from the Crypt?
No, I'm talking about Tales from the Dark Side.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. This was actually on like regular like free cable, and okay. it was in like 89 maybe.
Was original release 1983 up until 1988. Okay. So September actually official was September 30th, 1984 to July 24th, 1988. So yeah. So, but yeah, you're talking, you know, like a year later. I mean, mm-hmm. I probably saw, you know, Poltergeist like a year after it came out. And I was a little bit, you know, let's see if I was 76, I'm trying to figure out like how old I was. I mean, I was like 6 years old, man. I was like a little bit older than Carol Ann when I saw that movie.
I was probably eight.
Okay.
When I first saw it.
Yeah.
You know, so really, if you think about it, that's probably a good age to see it. I mean, because it's scary.
It is.
And but it's pretty harmless. And besides that, I mean, but it's scary when you're 8 years old, and as you get older, it just becomes kind of fun and spooky.
Yeah, like me and my wife actually watched it like one, you know, weeknight or whatever, and she's like, "Should we watch this before we go to bed?" I'm like, "I don't think it's that scary. It's rated PG. I don't think it." I immediately thought, you know, my childhood memory is probably deceiving me that I think it's scarier than it really is. And it is. And one more thing I'll say about, you know, my childhood experience, and then I'll move on, is that I didn't really understand when they were talking about like go towards the light and all this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. I didn't realize that until now, and I'm an adult and I'm watching it later. I'm going, oh, they're meaning like if you go to the light, you're going to die. Like, I didn't get that concept as a kid. I didn't understand that at all. So
that's another thing that really kind of bled into pop culture again, where it just kind of got ingrained in like the way we think of things, was the idea of don't go into the light, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's all from Poltergeist. So it's a very important film, and it's one of those cool important films where it holds up really well, and it's so well made.
Yeah.
And it's so fun.
Yeah, it's like a, you know, if you take E.T., and, you know, put some paranormal spin on it and make it a horror. That's what you have. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's basically like a spooky E.T.
Yeah.
Really.
Yeah. So let's move on to The Monster Squad. Now, before we get started, this is one of your favorite movies.
I do love this movie a lot. It's a movie that I saw countless times growing up. I taped it off HBO, watched it a ton.
And I've actually seen you wear the same shirt that the main character, Sean Crenshaw, wears. It says, it's like the Stephen King rules or whatever, right? The red shirt with like the blocky yellow writing that says Stephen King rules.
Just this terrible looking 80s shirt that just says Stephen King rules. Yeah, I got that at a horror convention. I'm like, I got to own that, man, because that expresses my love of two things I like a lot. Monster Squad and Stephen King.
Right.
Yeah. And there's one thing I got to bring up about Monster Squad really quickly.
Okay.
There's some language in it that it's really not okay in 2020.
Yes.
But you got to watch these movies in the context of when they were made. I just want to say that, you know, there's some really not cool language. If you have a problem with language that is offensive to modern sensibilities, please be warned that there is offensive language in this film. That it's kind of hard to hear in 2020.
Yeah, that even the main characters say. I mean, it's like,
yeah.
I know they, and we can talk about it in a little bit later, but I know they mentioned, like, one of the kids you know, is his name is Horace, but I mean, he gets called Fat Kid, you know, but I mean, that's just like one example, but I mean, but we'll get into that in a minute. But yeah, it was, this has a lot of like kids where it's kind of like middle, like, what are they, middle school kids or whatever? Well, like,
they've got to be like, they got to be like sixth grade.
Yeah. You know?
Because they mentioned that Rudy, the cool kid, like the really hip one, is in junior. They say in like hushed tones, he's in junior high.
He's in junior high. It was made in 1987. It was written by, I mean, the director is Fred Decker, which I don't know what he did before, but go ahead.
I can go ahead and clarify that. Yeah. Fred Decker did another really great horror comedy called Night of the Creeps,
okay,
which I highly recommend if you've never seen it. And he also wrote and directed. Or he didn't write, but he directed RoboCop 2, of all things. RoboCop 2.
Okay. Well, yeah. He also is a co-writer on this movie, but it was mainly written by a guy that we've talked about on the show before named Shane Black. Mm-hmm. Which Shane Black, he wrote Lethal Weapon, Lethal Weapon 2, The Predator, The Last Boy Scout. That's where we saw him because the title... of the movie The Last Boy Scout, the working title for that film was Die Hard, which got stolen from another movie which he did not write. He also wrote The Last Action Hero, The Long Kiss Goodnight, and Iron Man 3. That was his latest movie that he wrote.
When his latest movie is actually one called The Nice Guys, which I highly recommend. I'm going to get you a copy of that, Ryan. So I'm going to lend you my copy so you can watch The Nice Guys.
Okay.
It's got Russell Crowe in it. It's really good.
Oh, okay. Yeah, because I think Iron Man 3 was like 2012 or something like that. Like yeah, it was a few years back.
Yeah, well, I'm definitely a big Shane Black fan.
Yeah, so I mean, he has written a lot of action movies, a lot of great movies, but this one is like an action movie. And one of the reasons that I like this is that there's a lot of familiar like monsters. And yeah, I'll just give you the real quick synopsis. And is young kids from a club that is devoted to monsters, but soon get more than they bargain for when Count Dracula adjourns to Earth, accompanied by Frankenstein's monster, the Wolfman, the Mummy, and the Gilman. Because they, anyway, I'll say that in a minute.
They can't say Creature from the Black Lagoon.
They can't say Creature from the Black Lagoon. All right. The Uglies are in search of a powerful amulet that will grant them power to rule the world. Our heroes, the Monster Squad, are the only ones daring to stand in their way.
And the movie basically gives you no other real backstory.
No.
I mean, basically, like, nope. Just monsters show up and these kids fight them.
Well, sort of. In the beginning, there's, like, a little scroll. Like, it's, like, old world, you know, kind of thing. And they talk about Van Helsing and stuff like that. And then, like, you know, back in, like, 1897, like, you know, 100 years ago, these... people could have rid the world of monsters, but they messed up. And then it's like,
yeah,
you're in this scene in like, Germany, at like, you know, in the middle of the night, and there's some girl trying to read like some German text, and you don't know what's going on. But anyway, there's like an amulet that's glowing, and then there's like, it opens up this like black hole portal. But then she gets sucked in it, and so does, like, Van Helsing, right?
Yeah. And basically, the monsters win in the prologue.
Yeah.
And then you cut to, like, 1980s, and you've got these kids who are, like, in a clubhouse, and they're obsessed with monsters. And one of them basically ends up with a book. His mom finds him at, like, an estate sale, and it's basically Van Helsing's diary.
Yeah.
Now why Van Helsing's, you know... descendants were living randomly in the suburbs? Who knows? It doesn't matter. The movie's not concerned with any of that kind of stuff.
No. And I will say, I mean, the budget for this movie was like $12 million. The budget for like for Poltergeist was like $10.7 million. And this movie was made like, you know, 5 years later in 87. Yeah. And it almost has the same, you know, budget. And, you know, so there's not a lot of stars in this movie. And I remember watching this and going, wait, I recognize that. Where have I seen him from? Wait, I know that kid. Where have I seen him from? I know that person. Where have I seen him from? And I realized as I'm watching all of it, I all know them from this movie. I don't know them from anywhere else.
Well, they're all from
the... Yeah, because I did actually see this movie when I was a kid.
Oh, you did? Okay,
yes,
yeah.
I have seen this movie. And I was like, oh, yeah, I have seen this movie. But it was one of those that I probably only saw, like, maybe a couple of times.
Yeah. Well, everyone in this movie basically had done a lot of TV. And a lot of them went on to do a lot of TV. None of them had, like, huge careers, really. Except for, oddly enough, the guy who played Frankenstein, who mm-hmm. was a guy named Tom Noonan.
Right.
He was in Michael Mann's Manhunter. He was in RoboCop 2, directed by the same guy. He was the villain in Last Action Hero. So he's been in a lot of films playing like makeup covered bad guys.
Mm-hmm.
But been in a lot of big movies. But everyone else really is mostly full of like TV actors. Like the guy who plays the dad was on like Hill Street Blues and that USA show Suits.
Mm-hmm.
And the cool kid Rudy. Like the bad boy of the group, he was on Kids Incorporated back in the 80s.
Right. And yeah, yeah, and his, like, and his actor's name is Ryan Lambert, but not the singer Ryan Lambert.
No, not at all.
There's another Ryan Lambert who's a singer. This is not the same guy. And then Michael Fastino. But there's also like other people, like the detective. His buddy, he was in like Fried Green Tomatoes. One of the other like bully kids, was the older brother in the Wonder Years, Jason Hervey.
Yeah, Jason Hervey.
And then the pilot that was piloting the plane.
I was going to bring that up. so you recognized him,
yeah,
huh?
He's from Vice Versa.
And he was also in UHF. So he's an alumni of the show. He's all over the place. That guy's name is
David Provol.
David Provol.
Yes,
yeah.
David Provol. Thank you. I mean, yes. I was like,
Vice Versa's David Provol. Yeah.
There he is.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Awesome. 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 So, but he's only in it for like, you know, like one quick scene.
The scene on the plane with Dracula is pretty great. That explains how Dracula gets to America.
Yeah. Where he just like. Yeah. Drops him out of the sky, and then he lands in the swamp there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That Gilman just happens to be at too. You know?
Yeah. So let's go back and count the monsters, right? These monsters descend upon this town because there's the amulet. They're trying to get to the amulet, right? And you have these kids who are, you know, they're obsessed with monsters, but they have no idea what's coming, right? They just like monsters because they're kids, right? And they read comic books and
watch movies.
Watch movies and stuff like that. So, because I think one of the conversations that the kid has with the dad is about like some Friday the 13th type movie. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Groundhog Day Part 12. Yeah.
Where the killer somehow comes back to life. You know what I mean? So,
yeah.
I don't know where I was going with that. Oh, but so that's the plot. But we have Count Dracula is the guy that's the head guy. And if you look at the artwork, I mean, you definitely you're like, oh yeah, there's that guy from the poster.
He's basically like a generic Bela Lugosi.
Then you have a wolf man, right? You have a mummy. And you have Frankenstein's monster, and you have the Gilman. Now he's credited as Gilman, but we're supposed to accept as the creature from the Black Lagoon.
Well, and they actually call him creature in the movie too, because there's one scene where the little kid drops his Twinkie in the water and the Gilman grabs it, and the kid goes, "Creature stole my Twinkie."
Oh yeah, but he doesn't say specifically, because that was like Frankenstein's monster. I mean, that's like public domain, right? Like,
yeah,
Dracula is like public domain. The mummy is like public domain, and
but the creature from the Black Lagoon is not.
Yeah, Wolfman, that's like public domain. But yeah, that's the only like specific one. Yeah,
yeah. So we haven't also talked about who actually plays the Wolfman in his human form.
What do I have? I have. Hold on. Where'd he go? Oh, yeah. Carl Thibault.
No, his name is John Grease.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. John Grease.
Yeah.
Or John.
Do you know what John Grease is from? What else he's been in?
No.
He was Uncle Rico in Napoleon Dynamite.
Oh yeah, that's right. He was Uncle Rico.
Yeah. So I imagine Wolfman could throw that football over the mountain. He just needed to wolf out. He could have got the ball over it, man.
Well, he already got shot by the silver bullet, man. Anyway,
it's the only way to kill a werewolf.
Only way. And so that's the thing, is like the dad of Sean, who's kind of like, Sean is the leader of the group. I mean, he even says at one point, like, I'm the leader of the group. I just thought too, just for talking about the actors right quick, Robbie Kiger plays like his buddy, Patrick Rhodes. I don't think they even say his name like once in the movie. Maybe the mom says it like, hi, Patrick. Or maybe they're talking about Patrick's sister. I don't even remember them saying his name.
I know Patrick's sister doesn't have a name. But like, the movie is so unconcerned with like details,
names, like, oh, should we join the group? I mean, they're talking about, like, should we bring him in the group? You don't even know what group they're talking about.
Yeah, like the old man who helps him, the one who helps him translate Van Helsing's book, they call him Scary German Guy, and he never gets a name.
No.
He's literally just Scary German Guy.
Leonard Cimino is credited as Scary German Guy, and he's been in a ton of movies, too.
Yes, he's been in lots of things. Like, he was in Dune. He was in David Lynch's Dune.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, like, the movie's just so unconcerned with that. Like, it only cares about monsters doing cool monster things and kids doing like fun kid things.
Right.
Like, it's so unconcerned with anything else. It doesn't care why they're all there. It doesn't care to explain how they all get there. They're just there. Mm-hmm. It's like, hey, here's a mummy. Here's Dracula. And if you start to go, well, why is this here? And the movie goes, it doesn't matter. Here's Wolfman.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and just it keeps throwing this stuff at you. And I kind of love that about it. I love how it's just so unconcerned with that stuff that really doesn't matter.
Well, we were talking about in the pre-production, like, I mentioned that Count Dracula, you know, sends the monster of Frankenstein, you know, off, you know, to get the amulet from the kids or whatever. But then, like, because they're kids and they're innocent, you know, kids or whatever, like, he, like, becomes, like, almost a member of the group. And they just, like, bring him in, like, oh, you're Frankenstein's monster. Like,
In 30 seconds, there's, yeah. Like, no, like, we gotta learn to trust him. It's just, like, they're there, like, scared for, like, a second, but they're, like, it's cool. He seems nice.
Yeah, and then they just start calling him Frank. Like, you know, he's just, like, one of the guys. Like, just like your Uncle Frank.
Yeah, there's so many things like that. Like there's and I joked around with you earlier, like, suddenly Dracula's got a car that can turn into a ghost and drive through other cars. Why is that there? It doesn't matter. It looks cool. No. That's all that matters.
He landed, he landed on the, you know, he dropped out of the plane. He flies around like a bat. And then, like, but all of a sudden he has this car with, like, a skull, you know, figure on the front of the car, like, and the hood ornament or whatever, and then, like, but it can go invisible if needed.
Yeah, why not? Who cares?
Right.
It's fun, you know?
Yeah. So, I mean, to me, though, overall, it had a very, like, sort of Goonie-esque sort of quality about it, where
It is so much the Goonies with the Universal Monsters, yeah.
Yeah, where they're trying to, like, get these monsters, they're trying to, because they realize they get the German guy to translate the book, and they realize, you know, they have to complete this mission or whatever, and that's what they have to do, and so it just becomes about that and how they're going to defeat the monsters. So, and then, but then there's, like, you know, of course the showdown and the city square, which also, by the way, is shot in the same city square as many other movies, like Gremlins and Back to the Future. And because I think at one scene, you can, like, clearly see the clock tower.
Mm-hmm, you can, yeah.
You're like, hey, there's the clock tower. So, but what's your favorite part about, you know, about the movie? Like, what captures, you know, your spirit about this movie?
Well, it's because it's so kid friendly, but at the same time, it's so violent. Like, it is so incredibly violent for what it is. Like, you have scenes of, like, you know, of like the creature getting shot with a shotgun point blank, and it's like chest exploding, and then blowing up the Wolfman with dynamite, of Dracula, like, picking up the little girl and calling her a bitch, you know? Like, it's like this weird, like, cross-section of really childlike, but then being, like, really too, like, intense for kids at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're a kid, that's really kind of intriguing. That's what intrigued me so much about it as a kid, was it was very kid-friendly, but there were things in there I kind of knew I shouldn't be seeing. Mm-hmm. It was too dark and too violent.
Mm-hmm.
It was like this great little mix, and it just always kind of worked for me there.
Yeah.
But I really just love that it has this sense of, like, breakneck pace. Like, again, it's like nothing matters but just moving the plot forward. It's such a quick, brief movie, and it's full of, like, great lines.
Oh, yeah.
Like, the idea of, like, you know, creatures stole my Twinkie, or the scene where they're all putting their hands into to, like, christen the monster squad, and then the dog puts his hand on top of everyone else's hand, and they're like, how did the dog even get up here? And then it immediately cuts to the next scene.
Or mummy like was that. In my room.
Yeah.
Yeah, that little kid has all the good lines.
Yeah, we can't skip over the greatest line of all, and it's got the greatest line of all time. Wolfman's got nards. That is literally that's poetry, no, Ryan.
Was it kick Wolfman in the nards?
Yeah, no, it's both. It's like kick him in the nards. When he goes, Wolfman doesn't have nards. Just do it, and he kicks him in, and then Fat Kid, he goes in like a sense of awe, like he's got like this the sense of like shocked awe. He goes, Wolfman's got nards. And I'm sorry, when you're 10 years old, yeah. that is the funniest thing I'd ever seen as a kid.
Okay, so let's just explain. I mean, it's kind of like a cross of like a bunch of different movies that I think that they sort of borrowed from. And you know, good writers like, you know, Shane Black, they don't steal, they borrow, right? So he's borrowing a little bit of Goonies. He's borrowing a little bit of, like, you know, vampire films and stuff like that. He's borrowing a little bit of Gremlins, you know, kind of thing. It's all sort of like sort of ties in together, and you can probably like watch this movie and probably mention three or four other movies that he's pulling from. But it's just like a little bit of all that stuff, I think, like wrapped up into one movie. The movie's only 82 minutes long. So it's not even an hour and a half.
It may be the shortest thing we've watched.
It definitely is. 82 minutes is like, that is a breakneck speed for them to go from, you know, just like, you know, this opening scene, and then like the kids modern day, they're at school, and then like at the end, they're like, you know, killing the monster. And there is a little bit of violence. I mean, like you said, there is a scene where you know, the junior high kid, you know, it takes wooden stakes and has to stab these, you know, like kind of zombies. You bring
that
over.
That's actually my favorite scene in the entire movie because it's so badass. Like,
it is.
The Brides of Dracula are coming down the street and all the kids are scared. And like the older kid, Rudy, you know, grabs his bow and arrow and he starts walking towards them. And they're like, Rudy, what are you doing? And he goes, I'm in the GD club, aren't I? that's such a badass line. And even now I think that's pure Shane Black, just that kind of, you know, like blasé fair, like I'm going to go kick some ass, don't worry about it, I'll be back in a second. That's totally the kind of line that Bruce Willis would say in like The Last Boy Scout, you know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you see him making, you know, these wooden stakes earlier in woodshop, you know what I mean? Like, you see him, he's like, the teacher comes around and he shows him like this box he's working on. Then as soon as the teacher like turns, he's like, you know, gets out the belt sander, is like sharpening up the point of the wooden stake. You know what I mean?
Yeah, like, I think, and it's got that great song. It's got that great 80s pop song. I think it's one of the best 80s montage scenes. I really do think Monster Squad's Rock Until You Drop It is one of the best 80s montages.
It is very 80s.
It's so well cut.
Yeah, but it's weird because it's like all the other music in the film was very sort of traditional, I guess you would say, and eerie, you know. Sort of, and then it's like, then you just have a montage in the middle of it. It seems so almost ridiculous.
But that song is just an earworm, man. I'll be like for days later saying, you know, just walking around my house going, Rock Until You Drop. You know, just... Like, literally for days afterwards, I'll just be, like, mumbling it to myself, you know?
Yeah. And we, it's definitely great seeing them get prepared, because it's like, you know, and the whole movie only takes place, both of these movies, really. Well, I don't know, Poltergeist, maybe a few days or a few weeks. But this movie definitely only takes place in, like, 2 days, right? Like,
yeah.
It's very quick. And then also we mentioned the kid they called, you know, Fat Kid. And, like, I don't know. It's like he gets called Fat Kid by the bullies. But then, like, you know, later on you see, you know, the kids also in his own club, you know, will say stuff like, well, oh, man, Fat Kid farted. And, yeah. You know, and it's, I mean, it's kind of, it's not very.
It's, they're super mean to him. Yeah,
yeah. I mean. And not only that, there's a couple other things I wouldn't, that I won't mention, yeah, but
I will say that they use derogatory slurs for people who are gay.
Yeah.
And it's super jarring.
But I mean, so did like the Wonder Years too, you know what I mean? It's like,
yeah.
So,
but one thing that does bug me about Monster Squad is that they do it a lot in the very beginning. Like, it's something they say like 4 or 5 times, and I just cringe every time.
Yeah.
But, you know, yeah, again, you have to take these things as how they're made. And but to go back to Horace, to Fat Kid, he kind of gets to, but he's one of the few of them that gets to be really brave, because he gets the shotgun at the end. He's the one who kills the creature, mm-hmm. in like this action hero kind of way. Like he like blows the creature from the Black Lagoon away with a shotgun.
Yeah, like right in front of the kids that were picking on him earlier in the movie. You know what I mean? He gets, yeah. You know, they wouldn't let him in, you know, let him in. So he's like, all right, well, fine. You know, you get that fight or flight. And he's like, well, I'm going to fight. And, you know,
yeah.
Does that badass move and shoots him. And then the other guy, yeah. Ryan Lambert, like, he gets to shoot the wolf man. That was one of my favorite scenes, where he does shoot the wolf man, and you see the wolf man come up like he's, you know, he's not the wolf anymore. He's like the regular guy, and he looks at him. He goes, "Thank you," you know.
Yeah.
But it's almost like questioning, like "Thank you." So it's like kind of like weird. So yeah,
he's throwing the football over the mountain in heaven now. But yeah, God, I mean,
quesadillas. Yeah. All right.
But yeah, Monster Squad. It's just it's. I think that Black and Decker, you know, pun totally intended. I think both those guys realize that the key to making this movie work is just to make it super snappy. Like, it's rapid.
Yeah.
Because they don't want you to think about any of it. They just want you to get in, have fun, and get out, you know?
Yeah. Well,
yeah, and it works so well.
There were some scenes that were cut out. I do know, it's not in my notes, but I remember reading that the studio wanted to keep it under 90 minutes. So that was like, no, we got to, you know, it's for kids. They don't have an attention span. We're going to make it like less than 90 minutes. It's like, okay.
If I remember correctly, the Blu-ray has some of the original Blu-ray has some of the deleted scenes.
The original Blu-ray is copied from the original DVD, and that had the special edition. It is out of print, so
yeah, I've got it. So okay. that's one of my treasures, because you can't get it anymore.
I'm sure you can find it on eBay or other places that you can find DVDs. Yeah, I'm sure the Blu-ray is more than the DVD.
Yeah, I definitely don't pull it out of my collection a lot. I got this one on digital, so I wouldn't have to worry about pulling my copy out of my collection.
Yeah, but I mean, it just has a fun ending and enjoyable movie. I mean, it's just like you can watch it. It's a great Hollywood. That was the other movie that I was going to mention. Like, yeah, Gremlins. Like kind of like the Lost Boys, kind of like Goonies, mm-hmm. and then the other one I was gonna say is the Mighty Ducks, kind of like all that sort of like wrapped up together. So it's not as it's not as kitschy, as campy as like Mighty Ducks, but it's not as like horror movie as like Gremlins. You know, it's just like kind of hits the mark, but it's also not even as scary as the Lost Boys. You know what I mean?
So yeah, it's like it's kind of a little bit of all of them. It's kind of like this like cinematic goulash.
It is
of different like flavors.
Yeah.
So what was your favorite? If you were gonna rewind and savor a scene, what was your favorite scene in in Monster Squad.
Ah, that is that's a tough one. Because I mean, there were just so many good scenes. I think that one of my favorite. Actually, I'll say this. This is gonna sound stupid, but I love when the dad comes home and they're watching, like, the kids, like, watching the horror movie on the drive-in with his binoculars. Yeah. And the dad comes in and, like, brings them, like, McDonald's, you know? And he's like, hey, yeah, what's going on? That's a good
bonding scene, yeah. For me, I think it is RJ's fight with the vampire women and, like, the werewolf. I love his, like, that when it becomes, like, a little bit of a badass action movie for a bit. I do like those scenes. Mm-hmm. And one thing I absolutely love, and that we can't go without talking about, is the wonderful, and I mean wonderful, creature effects in Monster Squad.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we've almost got this entire episode and not mentioned them, but they were designed by Stan Winston, who did
the
Predator.
The costumes were great. The costumes were so good. I mean, the Wolfman, I've never seen, like, a Wolfman that looks like that.
Well, that's awesome. One thing I love about them is that they remind you of the Universal monsters without actually looking anything like them.
Yes,
which is it had to be such a hard thing to do, and to make them look cool in their own right, but to be completely original designs that feel like those classic characters, but still look cool by themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Oh man, there's the designs of those things, and the costumes are just amazing. Such beautiful practical effects work by Stan Winston. And, I mean, it's one of the highlights of the entire film. They are just gorgeous to look at. And like, when Dracula's transitioning into a bat, and he's like that mm-hmm. half-bat, half-man thing.
Oh, yeah.
Such a cool effect, man.
Oh, yeah. When he's like, so kind of like amazing, the bug, practical, like, sitting there on the floor or whatever. Like, yeah.
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 For some, I guess bullets hurt like Bat Dracula for some reason. It doesn't matter. It's cool. That should be the tagline for Monster Squad. Yeah. The tagline should be, it doesn't matter, it's cool.
Or that Wolfman could get blown up by a stick of dynamite, and then, like, he's back together in, like, 5 minutes.
Like he zips back together like Legos.
Sure.
Why not?
Yeah, only, you know, and then, like, you know, and then he goes off and, you know, and it's like, yeah, nothing kills a vampire except for a silver bullet. You know, it's like,
yeah, and you know what? It is cool, and it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Monster Squad rocks.
Yeah,
but so does Poltergeist. Now, as far as scenes I don't like about Monster Squad, I'm gonna get negative for just a second.
Uh oh.
Only thing I don't like about it, it's a bridge too far for me, is the army showing up at the end with Eugene's crayon letter.
Yeah,
okay. There's part of the montage where the youngest member of the Monster Squad writes a letter to the army in crayon, and it literally says, "Dear Army guys, come send help. Monsters are here." And you see him put it in an envelope and mail it, and then at the end, like the army shows up with his letter. They show up too late, of course. That's because they get the gag.
Yeah,
but to me, that's almost a bridge too far. Like, I'm glad it's right there at the end, because you can just let it go. But even as a kid, I was just like, that's too much.
Mm.
That is just too much silliness. But then it's over, so it's okay.
Well, you don't think, Frankenstein just, like, walking off with him in the sunset, like, wasn't enough? That didn't do it?
I like that scene, man.
I know
that was it's like a really weird version of Stand By Me.
yeah. I don't think that there's so much just I don't think you barely can take anything out that you don't want that you want to skip past. You know what I mean? I think you've already mentioned it before. The bad stuff about being insensitive towards, the LGBTQ community, I think is, not my bag. But I will have to say
it's bad.
Sure, Shane was probably, like, that's the way that kids, you know, talk to each other and put each other down. I mean, I lived through that era. I know what kids said, and they did call each other those names, but, you know, it's a little insensitive. But, you know, I had to fast forward through the scenes now, that's what I'd do.
Yeah, it makes me cringe. That's all I can say about it. It makes me cringe.
All right. Well, let's get to we didn't even do the thing. Poltergeist. We got to do that at the end. Sorry.
It's okay.
I am lost.
You're so overwhelmed by the awesomeness of these two movies, because this was a great week for our movies, man.
Oh yeah,
both these were so much fun.
Fun. Yeah, because you have one sort of family movie that's a little bit scary, and then you have a one like just really silly, ridiculous, like somewhat cartoony, but still a little bit serious about all these monsters. So it's all these classic monsters. It's really cool, really fun. Anyway, all the notes, Poltergeist, we mentioned before at the beginning of the show about a directorial sort of questioning how much Steven Spielberg had a heavy hand in making Poltergeist. Okay. So apparently there was a clause in Steven Spielberg's contract with Universal Studios that prevented Spielberg from directing any other film while preparing for E.T. So he was on set. He did a lot of things. He, was very involved. So after the movie came out, the Directors Guild of America actually opened an investigation into the question of whether or not Hooper's official credit of director was legitimate and not like, where Spielberg was kind of directing from the back seat. So the investigation ended in an arbitrator's ruling that MGM Universal Entertainment had to pay $15,000 to the director, Toby Hooper, because the studio gave producer Steven Spielberg a bigger credit than Hooper got in its trailers.
Yeah, and people have definitely discredited Hooper a lot, saying that he didn't direct the movie. I mean, I've heard those stories for years, but I think anyone who knows Hooper's style will see his influence really heavily, especially in those scenes where, in the beginning, where like the lights are flickering and it's just the static of the TV and those early scenes of tension. Those are pure, and the sound design is kind of there to unnerve you. Like you hear like the static and it makes you kind of antsy. That is 100% pure Hooper. And I think that he's been unfairly maligned by a lot of the horror community, because he's a very gifted director. He's a gifted writer, and I think that he collaborated with Spielberg a lot, but I still think it's his movie.
Well, one of the other producers, Frank Marshall, which Frank Marshall, no relation to Gary Marshall, right? But he basically is quoted in saying that he told the Los Angeles Times at the time that the creative force of the movie was Steven. Toby was the director on set every day, but Steven did the design for every storyboard, and he was on the set every day except for 3 days when he was in Hawaii with George Lucas. However, Hooper stated that that he did fully half of the storyboards. So in a 2000 interview in Rubenstein, Zelda Rubenstein discussed her recollections of shooting the process and said, quote, "Steven directed all 6 days that she was on set. Toby set up the shots and Steven made the adjustments." So from what I read, it was kind of like there was like some setup, and then Toby would be like, "Well, okay, I got everything set up. What do you think, Steven?" And then, it was so, and sometimes he would, make some adjustments or not make some adjustments. So I don't know. I think
it's a creative process. I think it's a creative process. So I think anytime you get that kind of thing, like a movie, it's a lot of individuals. And I think that I don't think you can completely discredit Spielberg or Hooper. They obviously work together. You can feel both of them in the film. And to me, it doesn't really matter. What matters is the movie's really good.
Well, and you have to remember, Spielberg was the producer. So, he is the one that has to sign off on it and this is what we're making. But at the end of the day, I think that you're right. It does have like a lot of elements of Spielberg in it, probably more so than other movies from Amblin Entertainment, I would think. But yeah, I think overall, it's not all Steven. I do see some of Toby Hooper quite a lot. You know what I'm saying? So
yeah.
The house used in the film for this movie is located in Simi Valley, California, where it still stands today. So it did not get wiped out at the end of the movie like it says. Spoiler alert. The family who owned it sold it in May of 2009.
Yeah, I'm sure they had no trouble selling that. I'm sure someone was ecstatic to have the Poltergeist house.
I know. That would be weird. The inspiration for the story of the movie comes from an actual occurrence in Denver. Did you know about this?
I did not.
Okay. In the late 1800s, when Denver was expanding, there was a graveyard where the city government wanted to put a Grand City Park. The city went with the lowest bidder to relocate the graves of the people who they couldn't afford to move. There were a lot of like people who just like wandered into town, you know, vagrants, you know, gold, you know, people searching for gold, you know, that sort of thing. Those are the ones that were like kind of left. And about so they got the lowest bidder to relocate all of them. And about a third of the way into the project, the contractor realized that he had seriously underbid the job and started moving just the headstones. He completed the job, and when the city building, started building the structure that they wanted to build on the park, they were actually getting close to finishing when one of the contractor's employers spilled the beans. And the contractor was arrested, but the city could not afford to tear down the building and dig up the cemetery again. So they just completed the project. I can't read my own stuff here. Just leaving the unmarked graves as they were. So it still stands today. There are the graves under, and it's still there in the middle of downtown Denver, Colorado. And you can go visit Chessman or Cheeseman Park. So they are under the Greek Pavilion on the east end of the park and extend south towards 8th Avenue. And it's a big path. So that apparently, and then there's also like, people do tours and, you know, people like their ghost stories and stuff like that. So that was like a big like local legend. And that was the inspiration for the story for Poltergeist.
Well, there's a lot of weird stuff in Denver. If you look into the history of Denver,
yeah,
it's kind of odd that of all places to have kind of a weird, kind of occultish like history, it's that place. But yeah, that's I had not heard that, but that totally makes sense.
Yeah, and it's also a couple of things in the story. Like I mentioned, the tree and the clowns. That's based upon Steven Spielberg's childhood like fears. So he kind of threw that in there.
Yeah, those are very like universal things, man. Yeah. Like that clown is creepy. even to me as an adult, I wouldn't want that thing in my house.
The movie was nominated for Oscar for Best Special Visual Effects, Best Sound Editing, and Best Original Score from Jerry Goldsmith, who also did the wonderful music for Star Trek. But they all three of them lost to Steven Spielberg's other movie, E.T.
Which is a shame because, if anything, the sound design in Poltergeist is phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
Like just the ambient noise. Oh, man, it's so good.
Mm-hmm. I watch it on my little TV. I didn't watch it on my nice system or with headphones. I'll have to watch that one again. I'm sure it has a lot of really great sound.
Like just go back and watch like the early scenes when they're in like the bedroom and like the TV's flickering. Uh-huh. Oh, it's just the sound of the static. It gives you this great sense of like tension.
Mm-hmm.
So good.
And the visual effects. I love the strobing effects and all that kind of stuff too.
Oh, me too. Yeah, just those good old school like lighting effects. Oh, yeah. It's good stuff.
You mentioned the that famous saying, "They're here." That is number 69 on the American Film Institute's 100 Years, 100 Movie Quotes. So out of 100 of the popular lines, that's number 69. It's right under "Here's Johnny" from The Shining.
Yeah, I mean, it's ingrained in society now. It really is.
Yeah. The budget for the movie, like I mentioned, is $10.7 million. Box office, $121.7 million.
It was a massive hit. Yeah.
Yeah, it was like the eighth most popular movie, I think, in like 1983. I think, Just to compare, like E.T., what Steven Spielberg did that same year, the budget was $10.5 million for E.T., almost the same amount. But it was the number one movie that year, $792.9
million. Wow, man. That's a lot of money now. So you compare that to like back then, it's almost unfathomable.
Roger Ebert gave Poltergeist 3 stars. He called it an effective thriller, not so much because of the special effects as because Hooper and Spielberg have tried to see the movie's strange events through the eyes of the family members instead of just standing back and letting the special effects overwhelm the cast along with the audience. And I think I think that's what, you know, we sort of talked around is that, you know, there's that family element like within it, right? Yeah. So that it's more about like the story, but the special effects just enhance that a bit. And I think you can see Spielberg do that in a lot of other movies. You know, you see him do that in the alien movie,
Cocoon.
No.
Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
Cocoon. What's wrong with me?
No, that was Amblin Entertainment. I don't think that was Spielberg.
Don't mind me, man. It's been a long day.
But you see him also do that in like E.T. You see him do that in, Close Encounters of the Third Kind. You see him do it in Jurassic Park, even. Yeah. You know what I mean? He's just very, very good at that.
He really is. I mean, that's kind of his thing.
Well, yeah. We already said Roger Ebert. Rotten Tomatoes, critic score 85%, audience 79%. So there is a Poltergeist 2 and a Poltergeist 3. Poltergeist 2 stars most of the same cast. It's called Poltergeist 2 The Other Side in 1986, and Poltergeist 3 is from 1988. Rotten Tomatoes critic score of 2 is 35%. 17% for Poltergeist 3.
Yeah, they're kind of almost the classic examples of needless sequels.
Mm-hmm.
So not recommended.
There's even a remake of the original film in 2005 that was produced by Sam Raimi, Rob Talbert, and Roy Lee Stargan, starring Sam Rockwell, Jared Harries, and Rosemary DeWitt. And it has a Rotten Tomatoes critic score 31%.
It's funny because I had completely forgotten that existed till we started recording this.
Yeah.
Like that's how little that one stuck with me.
And announced in 2019, there's going to be yet another remake of the original by the Russo brothers, Joe and Anthony. Did you hear about this?
Well,
who the Russo brothers are, they are the ones who kind of created the Marvel Cinematic Universe films. Not created, yeah, but they're kind of behind a lot of them.
They're the guys who did the last two Avengers movies that made all the money in the world, so they can basically do whatever they want now.
Yeah.
And apparently they're going to remake Poltergeist, so that's tragic. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I don't like the idea, but
yeah. There's nothing better than the original. And I don't think there's really anything wrong with the original, to be quite honest.
It's not gonna have Joe Beth Williams and Craig T. Nelson in it, so what's the point?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. All right, moving on to the Monster Squad. The first draft of the film with Van Helsing accompanied the first draft of the film has Van Helsing accompanied by Zeppelins and hundreds of men on horseback storming Dracula's castle and would have more than doubled the budget for the film. So that had to get rid of it.
It sounds cool, though.
Yeah, sounds different. I like the intro the way that it is. I mean, you just need enough to explain the story. No reason to spend all your budget on backstory. On Zeppelins. Yeah. Zeppelins and hundreds of horses. And like we mentioned, due to licensing issues, the characters had to be suggestive but not exact copies. Andre Gower, who plays the main character Sean, and Robbie Keegar, they were friends in real life before filming. So Gower campaigned for the producers to hire Keegar to play the best friend of the role, Patrick. And I kept looking at him and I'm going, he looks familiar. What other stuff has he been in? And I looked him up and he hasn't been in anything. And then it dawned on me, dude looks so much like a young Corey Haim. It is unbelievable.
He kind of does, yeah.
Dustin Diamond had a small role as a kid who tries to pay baseball cards with the boys, but that was cut out.
Poor Screech.
Liam Neeson also was paid for a bit part, but that was never shot. So, the scene where Dracula lifts Phoebe up and she screams was done in one take. Apparently, the actor that played Dracula, like, he didn't want to, like, wear the contacts and the, you know, and the fangs and stuff like that in front of her. Yeah. So, when he lifted her up, they did, like, a scene, and the director told her, like, just scream, and he was like, when? And he said, you'll know. And then that's when he, like, he opened her eyes, you know, opened his eyes and you know, smiled at her with the fangs. And that scream is a real scream.
Yeah.
Legitimate scream. And that's also reminds me of another thing. So that has a similar tie-in to a story that I read about the scene with the poltergeist. There's a scene, you know, where the brother gets sucked up by the tree, and then Carol Ann is like on the bed and getting kind of like sucked into the like all the stuff in the room is getting sucked into the to the closet, and there's wind blowing. They use, you know, all these wind machines and all this other stuff. Apparently, like, they did one scene with her sitting on the bed and everything, like, she screamed, like, really loud, and they only did, like, you know, one take, and, you know, and then finally, like, they yelled stop, and she was, like, still screaming, and then she's like, I don't want to shoot anymore, and so Steven Spielberg was like, okay, none, no more, we got the take, that was it. Rotten Tomatoes scores of the Monster Squad. Critics, 62%. Audience, 78%.
Yeah, I would think the audience score would be higher, because I literally, again, I've mentioned this before, but I don't know anyone who doesn't adore Monster Squad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that speaks volumes right there, that the audience would love it more than the critics would. Back then, the cast did win the Young Art, like the whole cast, right? They won a Young Artist Award for the Young Artist Foundation for Outstanding Youth Actors and Actresses Ensemble in a Television or Motion Picture. So there was a 20th anniversary reunion of the Monster Squad when it was held with cast members and director Fred Decker. In April of 2006 in Austin, Texas, at the Alamo Draft House, two shows were held at the theater. Both were sold out, with lines forming around the block. Some audience members flew as far as from California to watch the film on the silver screen. And then in 2007, just like less than a year later, they announced that it was coming out on DVD. So I guess this is one of those films that like never was released on DVD.
Yeah, it was a big deal when it finally got put out on DVD, because I remember when this happened. I remember when that screening happened. It was a big deal, because this was a movie that was heavily traded amongst tape traders and bootleggers for years.
In 2008, there was rumors about a remake. Then in 2010, Michael Bay had rights from Paramount, but as of 2014, they confirmed that the remake was no longer happening. And if you want to learn more about the movie, in 2018, Andre Gower produced and directed a documentary about the legacy, the cult following, and the fans of Monster Squad titled Wolfman's Got Nards. The documentary...
You know...
Go ahead.
I've never seen it. I need to watch it. I'd forgotten about it till we started researching this. So I'm going to check it out probably within the next week or so, since we're in the Halloween season.
Let me check on justwatch.com and we'll see, because it basically says, I just had in my notes here that the documentary film is currently touring film festivals and film comic book conventions. So don't know if you can watch it like on anything streaming. And I'm looking up right now. Yeah, nothing. Like, I, you know. So I don't know where you can get it. I have no idea.
I don't even know if it's been released. I'll have to look into that. And once we find out, we'll be sure to post about it on Twitter and Facebook to let you guys know.
Right. There is an official trailer. You can go the website. If you search for it, you can find it. But yeah, it's played at different film festivals. So yeah, I don't really know from Pilgrim Media Group. Anyway, hopefully, you know, I'm sure maybe it'll come to our town. Maybe we can watch it sometime and maybe it'll be released.
By the time this episode comes out, I will have a concrete answer on what the deal is, and I will make sure to post that on Twitter.
Yeah, post it on Twitter. Maybe we'll put a little blurb on our website about it at video-culture.com. So now we have to go through our thing. Okay, so video store. We have the videotape. Are we going to return it, or are we going to keep it an extra day for Poltergeist?
I'm going to tell you, I'm going to just go ahead and say I'm going to keep both of them. These are two movies that I think are wonderful, that every geek movie fan should have them, or have at least seen them more than once. There's so much to appreciate about both these. I can't imagine not wanting to have copies of these in your collection.
I mean, I love Poltergeist. There are some moments that are a little bit slower. I mean, because it's like a 2-hour movie, but it's still like a great sort of like roller coaster ride, like of emotions, and it's still just so tied to my childhood. Then I don't think I'll be able to shake it. You know what I mean? So yeah, I'm with you. I'll have both films. I mean, I was a little bit older, like when Monster Squad like came out, and then when it started playing, because it was like 87. So, by then it was a little bit older, but I still appreciate, I know I've seen this movie a few times. So, yeah, it's a great, great movie. Great, fun movie for sure. Yeah. So movie suggestions. I'll go ahead and start. I know we talked in pre-production in like a lot of different movies, and we even mentioned a couple here. I mentioned The Goonies. I mentioned The Lost Boys. But I think I'm going to go with another movie that I remember now that I think is another good movie. Is a movie called The Silver Bullet, or just Silver Bullet, from 1995.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Based on the Stephen King short story, it's got Gary Busey in it. Yeah.
Yeah. Gary Busey, yeah. Everett McGill, Corey Haim. Like Gary Busey plays the guy in the wheelchair that they call like Silver Bullet. And, it's a great movie about this, you know, Wolfman. And it really made me like, we played a office version of like, Werewolf. And it really kind of reminded me, you know, it really kind of reminded me of the movie. And basically, yeah, it's like in a small town, brutal killings start to plague the close-knit community. Marty Coleslaw, a paraplegic boy, is convinced that the murders are the doings of a werewolf. And so it kind of gets like Gary Busey to like make a silver bullet. And it's like one of the, it's like the mayor of the town, or like, I can't remember. But anyway, you have to watch the film.
Yeah, I would definitely recommend it. Yeah, it got put out on a nice special edition DVD Blu-ray by a company called Shout Factory a couple years ago. Highly recommend it. It's super fun. It really is. That's a good call.
All right.
For me, I'm going to recommend a movie that is not really good for kids, but it's so very similar to one of the movies we talked about. Poltergeist has been kind of has inspired a lot of movies since it came out. But a movie series that came out in the past, you know, 10 years or so that I think is very, very similar to Poltergeist. And if you like Poltergeist, it's been good to watch, to kind of follow it up with. That's the Insidious series by James Wan. It stars Lin Shaye, who was in Kingpin and Something About Mary. She's sort of the Zelda Rubinstein character. But it's very much about a family who's dealing with malevolent spirits in their home. And kind of the way they kind of battle them with a medium. It's so very similar structurally to Poltergeist that I was really struck by how similar they were when I was rewatching Poltergeist for this episode. And in the Insidious series, there's three of them, I believe. And I think they're all a lot of fun. Like, again, they're not really kid-friendly, but they're not overly violent. They're just really scary. But if you like ghost stories and you like the idea of people battling evil spirits, it's a good series to check out.
All right. I will have to check that out. And I seriously want to check out Wolfman's Got Nards.
Yeah, I'm gonna figure that out. I'm gonna find out what's going on with that and see when that's gonna be available. Because I want to watch it. Because I had forgot they'd even made it. Because you know, with this whole quarantine and like 2020 being you know so weird, I'd kind of forgotten about some of the things that were going on before all this happened. So
yeah,
go
ahead.
I definitely want to find out about it now that I remember that that it's a thing.
The website is the squaddoc.com. So just how it sounds, the squaddoc.com is the website for Wolfman Got Nards. I'm going to go ahead and, recommend it, but you know, you can't watch it anywhere. You can watch the trailer. I think that's the only thing you watch online unless it comes, you know, film festival or somebody picks it up. So hopefully, one of these days it will get picked up by, you know, a company. We'll be able to watch it, hopefully, you know.
It's only a matter of time. So, you know, as we wrap up here, Ryan, I've got to ask, you know, did this put you more in the Halloween mood, my friend?
Oh, yeah.
Get you ready for the spooky season?
Oh, yes. Yeah, definitely. I love the scenes from the Monster Squad because it's done definitely, you know, in that sort of time period in fall and all that kind of stuff. And it definitely, you know, got me thinking about as we're getting ready for Halloween. I mean, it's already, we do these kind of like in advance, but I'm going to tell you right now, it is mid-September. You know, we're recording this in mid-September. I already have pumpkins on the front of my house, okay? Just saying.
Hey man, I love Halloween. Halloween's a big time of year for me too. This is what the way we're gonna get into the season. And by the time you guys hear this, it's gonna come out the week of Halloween. We guys hope you have a great time trick or treating. You know, party responsibly, social distancing, but have fun. Watch a lot of great horror films, and you know, just to give you an idea of what's going on next time, we're not done with people in costumes. We're not done with the Halloween spirit
or people in masks for that matter, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah,
or even really spooky stuff
because we're going to talk about, you know,
bats. Yeah, there you go, monsters. Yeah, yeah, it's
yeah. I mean,
and then that probably gives you an idea of what we're going to be talking about. But
we're going to be talking about when it came out in the 80s about bats. That's with people in masks. Oh wait, hold on, wait.
Yeah, we're going to be talking about one of the biggest films of all time on the next episode of Video Culture. But you know, until then. I'm Matthew Essery.
I'm Ryan Agri.
Go watch some movies, guys, and happy Halloween.
Thanks for checking out this episode of Video Culture. You can check us out on Twitter at Video Culture 2.
That's the number 2 for two guys talking about movies like Ryan and myself.
And you can also check us out on Facebook. Just search for Video Culture Podcast.
Also, be sure to stop by our official website, video-culture.com. There we have the entire show archives, as well as articles about film.
Yeah, so check us out. We'd love to hear from you.
Yeah, coming out with us, talk movies. Did you like the show? Do you hate the show? Do you like or hate the movies we talked about? Let us know. Come chat with us, and let's all watch movies together.
The Monster Squad gonna groove tonight. First came Dracula, now the Wolfman too. and the creature from the Black Lagoon. We need silver bullets, we need wooden sticks. Normal stuff won't stop because they live on hate. Speak some magic words from a virgin's lips. Maybe that'll shake you, make you slip and trip. There's no turning back, gotta fight to fight. Yeah, the Monster Squad gonna get it tonight. Monster Squad.
We're the Monster Squad.